Hello and welcome to the On Science podcast. I'm NPR science editor Alison Richards. This week, science news spans the arc of human history, from the discovery of what could be a new human ancestor to the launch of another shuttle into space. Then, with nuclear power poised for a comeback as a climate-friendly source of energy, we look at the up and the downside of nuclear reprocessing. And we also dive deep into the ocean and into our guts. But first, the space launch.
Three engines up and ready. Three, two, one, zero. Booster ignition and liftoff of Discovery.
Unless you're listening to this podcast a long time after it's posted, the crew of the space shuttle Discovery is probably still overhead somewhere. Now, NPR's Joe Palca has covered space for 25 years.
Yep.
But you've never seen a shuttle before.
Well, you know, I've seen it on TV. I have to tell you, it's quite a different experience to be down there. But it's a little bit like the difference of watching the Super Bowl on television and getting the commercials and watching it. Even if you're far up in the stands, it's still a completely different experience. And being at the launch when, you know, you have this giant countdown clock, and of course, you were there. I mean, the launch took place about 40 minutes before dawn, so it's like this really special time of the evening to begin with. And then you can see the little teeny hints of red off to the east where the sun is just beginning to poke up. And then, you know, the clock counts down and it gets to zero, and all of a sudden the sky brightens tremendously with this incredible fireball coming out from the bottom of this rocket. And you think, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. And then, bam, the sound slams you in the chest, because it's not just loud. I mean, I knew it was going to be loud, but what I really didn't anticipate was this feeling of air beating against your body as it's taking off. It is a remarkably powerful event to see in person. Obviously, you don't even see it as well from 3 miles away or wherever we were sitting as you do on television, but you cannot begin to experience the reality of the power of this thing unless you're actually there to see it.
And it was cool, too, because we saw the space station.
Well, I like that a lot, too. So it actually is a little bit of a lesson in orbital mechanics, because the space station, it's not in an equatorial orbit. It's an orbit that's kind of going toward the pole all the time, because it launches from Kazakhstan, which is up higher north. And so they can't do an equatorial orbit from there. So they launch in this higher inclination orbit. So that means the launch window has to be chosen when the space station is over the Cape, you know, or within a few degrees of the Cape, because otherwise you won't be able to catch it. So, you know, about 20 minutes before the launch, they announce on the public address system at the press center, go outside, look up toward the moon, and you can see the space station go overhead. So I took off my headphones and walked outside, and I looked toward the moon, which was about a half moon bright up in the sky toward the southeast. And just as I looked up, I could see the space station, this bright white spot, moving off toward the north across the moon and heading away, going faster than you would think a commercial airliner would go. And I think I heard them say that by the time the shuttle launched 20 minutes later, it was already over Ireland. And I'm sitting in Florida, 20 minutes later it's in Ireland. I'm thinking, boy, I wouldn't mind being in coach if I could go that fast. It's much nicer that way.
Now, there's what, 3 more shuttle missions to go before the end of the shuttle program?
I mean, these shuttles, they're not going to be disassembled when the missions stop. But yes, the plan now is for there to be 3 more, 2 during the summer, and then the last one, which is going to be Discovery again, the same space shuttle, to launch in mid-September. And that's it. Yeah, that's it. It's wild, because it really does sort of span my career. I guess the shuttle program started in 1981, so we're at the 29th anniversary. I think it's right about this week. And I started covering the missions probably in about 1985. And here we are. It's my career. Maybe it's time for me to stop. So if I retire the shuttle, I'll retire.
Well, it may or may not be the end of your career, Joe, but it's... It certainly made Nell Greenfield-Boyce, who also covers space on the science desk, wonder what was going to happen to the astronauts.
Chris Ferguson is a former space shuttle commander who's now deputy chief of NASA's astronaut office. He's also the drummer for a rock band in Houston. It's made up of about a dozen astronauts, but some members are often training, flying on the shuttle, or working on the space station. So usually only about five of the astronaut musicians are available to get together and jam.
I would like to think that perhaps we'll have some more time to practice here once the shuttle program comes to a slow end here at the end of this year or early next year.
NASA currently has about 80 active astronauts. Right now, Ferguson says, they're pretty busy, and they'll all have flown at least once before the shuttle retires. Usually, about a half dozen astronauts leave the agency each year to go do other things, like teaching or doing government jobs or working for aerospace companies. Ferguson says, after NASA mothballs the shuttle,
I would anticipate we'll see a few extra folks over and above our normal attrition rate might seek employment elsewhere.
That still leaves the agency with a lot of astronauts, plus 9 new astronaut candidates that were just hired last year. But there will be fewer missions, and those will be long-duration stays at the space station. The only way to get up to the station will be in a cramped Russian Soyuz capsule. NASA had been designing a new system of rockets and space capsules, but President Obama wants to cancel that program and instead rely on private companies to taxi astronauts to low Earth orbit. Many in Congress are fighting that plan.
You know, it's a very tenuous time for everybody here.
Ferguson says his astronaut colleagues aren't just concerned about their own futures, but also what will happen to all the expertise at NASA that's allowed America to put people into space.
It's certainly not an easy thing to do, and we want to make sure that we preserve that capability and that knowledge, you know, for future generations and whoever ultimately does take us up to the International Space Station and hopefully beyond low Earth orbit one day.
This isn't the first time NASA has had to make a big break with the past. When the Apollo program ended, astronauts had to wait years before the brand new space shuttles were ready to fly. But the whole situation was different back then.
There's uncertainty that's in the system today that wasn't necessarily there in the 1970s.
Roger Lanius is a historian at the National Air and Space Museum.
Even before the end of the Apollo program, NASA had an approved follow-on program, the space shuttle, and affirmed schedule for getting it completed.
These days, no one knows what NASA will be doing next. Meanwhile, private companies are moving forward with their efforts, raising the possibility of not just commercial space taxis, but also astronauts for hire. NASA administrator and former astronaut Charlie Bolden talked about that when he visited Kennedy Space Center in Florida earlier this year.
When we start using commercial capabilities to get people to low Earth orbit, does that mean that the astronaut office goes and says, I want to rent a spacecraft?
Or should NASA rent not just the space vehicle, but also a private crew of astronauts to go with it?
We need to have the discussion of how important is it to have a career astronaut contingent as opposed to none.
That's why the proposed new budget for NASA says the agency should have the National Research Council do an independent review of the astronaut corps, looking at what the role and size of the corps should be after the shuttle retires. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
We may be able to put people up into space, but it's still not clear quite how we became a species that can do this. Now, another piece has just been added to an already complicated puzzle. The bones of 2 very unusual pre-human primates were recently discovered in a cave in South Africa. Their owners lived nearly 2 million years ago, and scientists are now trying to sort out whether they might have been direct ancestors of humans or an experiment in evolution that didn't quite work out. Chris Joyce has this report.
The partial skeletons belonged to a juvenile about 9 to 13 years old and a female in her 20s. They were found in what was once a deep cave where they probably died. Scientists call them Australopithecus sediba, a new species. The famous fossil Lucy, found in 1974, was a type of Australopithecus. Scientists suspect some form of this creature evolved into the very earliest humans, the Homo lineage. Anthropologist Lee Berger from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa thinks these new creatures could be the one.
It does look like a good candidate ancestor of early Homo.
That's because their skeletons are such a bizarre mix of primitive and modern. They had long, ape-like arms and a tiny brain, but parts of the skull and the small front teeth are more like early humans, such as Homo erectus. They also walked upright with a long stride. Berger, who led the scientific team, says the combination of features is different from anything else on the human tree of life.
The lower limbs are incredibly surprising. The pelvis is very advanced, very similar to what we see in Homo erectus and Homo sapiens with long legs. It's a real mixed bag, and how it's going to fit in to that is really the question that's going to come out of the next months and years.
At 2 million years ago, they lived just after the time when the earliest humans are thought to have evolved.
The fossil record tells us that we transitioned between early Australopithecines, like the Lucy fossil, which are bipedal, but they don't walk the way we do. They have longer arms than we do. They have more primitive faces and heads than we do, to something that is very close to us.
Now, finding the ancient species that led directly to humans is kind of like claiming to find the golden fleece. Anyone who says that faces some stiff questioning from other scientists, such as Bernard Wood at George Washington University. Wood says the South African fossils look more like something from Lucy's tribe than early human ancestors.
The particular mix that this one has, the particular type of mosaic, I think probably is unusual. We need to find out a bit more to know whether it's really different enough to deserve its new species.
Even if it is a new species, Wood says there's not enough evidence yet to claim that it was a rung on some sort of evolutionary ladder that led to us.
I think actually the evidence from this new creature is more in keeping with not the analogy of a ladder, but the analogy of a bush. And there are lots of twigs in this bush going up towards the light. One of them actually reaches the surface of the bush, which is the present day, and that's the one that eventually leads to modern humans.
Wood says these creatures may have been on an evolutionary twig well removed from the human branch, one that simply died out. Scientists agree, though, that it's an exciting discovery, regardless of where these creatures fit in the story of human evolution. Wood says it could mean that upright walking may have evolved more than once among different species. Berger published the findings in the journal Science. He says, at the very least, the fossils may shed some light on how we got to be the way we are.
We've got that whole package there to look at and maybe can begin to define what belongs in the genus Homo and what doesn't.
It was Berger's son who found the first skeleton in what could be the high point of his young career.
Matthew wants to be a paleoanthropologist. It is going to be a hard discovery to beat. I hope he does. Thank goodness I found the second one. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to live in the home, would I?
And now Berger says they found a third and fourth skeleton still to be dug out. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Some people will do a lot for sushi, and so apparently will some bacteria. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a microbe that actually altered its genes in order to feast on an ancient version of the maki roll.
Say you're a bacterium. You're living in some person's gut. It's dark, no oxygen, really crowded.
You're actually in a community that consists of somewhere around 10 to 100 trillion residents.
Justin Sonnenberg is a microbiologist at Stanford. He says the gut is a place of great opportunity and even greater competition.
It's constantly perfused with food that we, the human host, are eating. And so the key there is to really battle for these nutrients.
That means consuming anything that comes down the pipe. To do that, gut bacteria have acquired bits of genetic code that let them produce lots of different digestive enzymes. But what if one day your human host started eating something totally different? Sonnenberg says that's probably what happened about 40,000 years ago when people first arrived in what is now Japan.
The humans started consuming a new dietary substrate, in this case seaweed, and therefore the bacteria in the gut had an incentive, if you will, to now access carbohydrate substrates that were present in the seaweed.
But they couldn't. They didn't have the genetic code to make the right enzyme. So how did they solve the problem? That might still be a mystery if it weren't for a group of scientists studying a bacterium that lives in the ocean. Jan Hendrik Heyman from the University of Victoria in Canada says this bacterium is often found on a type of red seaweed.
It's a seaweed that you, when you eat sushi and you eat maki rolls, this is the one.
It's called Nori. And when Heyman tested some of the genes from this bacterium, he found that, as expected, they made special enzymes to break down Nori. Once the team knew what genes to look for, they started to poke around in genetic databases to see how many other bacteria carried the same genes. Not surprisingly, nearly all of those bacteria lived in the ocean.
Except one that was in a human gut bacterium, and this human gut bacterium was extracted from Japanese individuals.
The team immediately realized what must have happened. When people in Japan began eating seaweed with their rice and fish, they ingested some bacteria from the ocean. And as these ocean bacteria passed through the intestine, they exchanged bits of genetic code with the gut bacteria. Bacteria actually do this sort of gene transfer all the time. Heyman says it provides them with a sort of evolutionary overdrive.
This can happen really quickly. I mean, we do it in the lab every day within a minute.
So a bacterium that can't digest nori one day can the next. This sort of digestive evolution has probably helped humans adapt to lots of new environments and lots of new foods. Unsurprisingly, bacteria in North American guts don't have the genes to break down seaweed. And Heyman says they probably never will, even if sushi becomes a staple in North America. That's because these days, seaweed is roasted before it's used to wrap a maki roll. So the bacteria are dead long before they reach your gut. Justin Sonnenberg says that's the case for most of what we eat these days.
We're undergoing a tremendous experiment right now. We're consuming a lot of really highly processed, calorie-dense food that's incredibly sterile, so they lack the microbial reservoirs for these gene transfer events.
Sonnenberg says that could be a problem for us humans. Bacteria help us digest new foods, modulate our immune systems, and even ward off some diseases. The study appears in the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The Obama administration is promoting nuclear power, and it's complicated by the fact that it has put an end to plans to bury nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain, Nevada. So a Blue Ribbon committee is now pondering what to do with the waste. One option they are considering is a process that would dramatically reduce its radioactive lifetime. Richard Harris visited a nuclear reprocessing plant to consider these issues.
Less than 1% of spent reactor fuel is made up of radioactive elements that last hundreds of thousands of years. And Cheryl Green at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee says the technology to remove those troublesome elements from waste is as old as nuclear reactors themselves.
So you're standing at the face of the X-10 graphite reactor, the world's first continuously operating reactor.
Green points up at a 24-foot-tall graphite block that's dotted with holes about the size of corks. It looks nothing like a power reactor, because it never was. Instead, it was called an atomic pile. And back in the 1940s, the world's first nuclear engineers used long metal rods to slide slugs of uranium into the holes along the front face. Nuclear reactions inside the pile turned uranium and the slugs to plutonium and a host of other radioactive elements.
It's hard to see it, but the slugs would fall out the back, and there's a trench. And you see the transport trench right here, and it would be moved along to the reprocessing building.
Back in the 1940s, scientists here were reprocessing those slugs to get at the plutonium to use it for nuclear weapons research. These days, nuclear power reactors also produce plutonium and similar elements. They're treated as waste. But technologists like Green would like to extract those elements from the waste and reuse them as nuclear fuel. In the process, that would also keep those long-lasting radioactive materials out of nuclear waste dumps. This is doable. Worldwide, about a quarter of spent nuclear fuel is reprocessed. But for reasons we'll get to in a few minutes, the United States stopped pursuing this technology in the 1970s. Now, with a possible nuclear energy renaissance on the horizon, there's interest once again. Not far from the historic first reactor, Green and his colleagues at Oak Ridge are taking a fresh look at reprocessing. Building 7920 has a simple white cinder block exterior. Inside this decades-old facility are some relics of the nuclear heyday. Today they're being used to manipulate and reprocess samples of waste from nuclear reactors. At the core of this building, technicians peer through 4.5-foot-thick windows made of glass and mineral oil, radiation shielding.
You want to grab that one? Yeah, it's up on the rack.
they use mechanical arms to manipulate highly radioactive material inside the hot cells.
You just dumped out a bucket full of tools, it looks like.
Unfortunately, they're not what we're looking for.
Jason Cook adroitly sorts through the tools with the mechanical arm. It seems awkward, but he says after 6 years of practice, it's pretty much second nature to him.
You ever just want to reach in there and with your arm?
No. You get used to them. It's not as bad as it looks.
This setup looks practically like a museum piece, but researchers here have recently used these hot cells to manufacture a sample of new reactor fuel made from spent nuclear waste. Green explains it contains plutonium and other long-lived radioactive elements. The idea is to send this material back into a reactor. There, it will generate more energy, and in the process, the long-lived radioactive materials will break down into elements with much shorter lifetimes. The resulting experimental fuel pellets look like short bullets.
So these are the first pellets that have been produced from commercial nuclear fuel, in which we did not produce any pure separated plutonium in the process.
This material in here had been in a nuclear reactor, and it's now safe enough that basically you can hold it in your hand in a glass vial in a plastic bag. But
everything's not as dangerous as it looks.
Green says if waste weren't such a hot-button issue, nuclear power would actually look pretty attractive. One person's lifetime nuclear waste would fit in a Coke can, which is tiny compared with the many tons of carbon dioxide the average American dumps into the atmosphere each and every year. And on a national scale, Green says it's not as much as you might think.
If I put in one place all of the spent fuel generated by all of the commercial nuclear power plants in the United States throughout history, all of that spent fuel could be fit into a pool of water 25 feet deep and 300 feet on a side.
The size of a football field. Right now, that waste needs to remain safe and secure for a million years, which is one reason even putting it in Yucca Mountain seemed like less than a sure thing. Reprocessing the waste wouldn't reduce its volume, but it would dramatically reduce its radioactive lifetime, and that could make waste storage a much easier problem to solve. So, why hasn't the United States adopted this technology? Well, it turns out if you think of it in terms of a way to make more nuclear fuel, that's a very expensive way to go. Frank von Hippel at Princeton, a longtime skeptic of nuclear fuel reprocessing, says it's likely to remain a very expensive substitute for starting from scratch with uranium ore.
The price would have to go up about 10 times for it to be economically justifiable to reprocess.
Von Hippel's main concern, though, is that this technology can promote the spread of nuclear weapons. In fact, India used the reprocessing technology we gave it in the 1970s to make a nuclear explosive. And that helped change our attitude toward reprocessing.
U.S. adopted the policy that we don't reprocess, you don't need to either.
Even so, England, France, Japan, and Russia have built reprocessing plants. But von Hippel says the technology is not proving to be a panacea, especially for Japan.
Well, the ironic thing is that, in fact, the plant isn't working. They spent $20 billion on it, and it's at this point 8 years behind schedule. So they, in fact, are having to devise interim storage for their spent fuel.
So von Hippel says from the standpoint of economics and nuclear proliferation, it makes the most sense to leave nuclear reactor waste alone. Cheryl Green at Oak Ridge agrees that policy issues and economics need to be considered in the debate over reprocessing.
Our job as researchers really is to remove the scientific and technical barriers and to provide options to our national leaders and to our country.
Commercial concerns play a role as well. The French company Areva is interested in selling a reprocessing plant in the United States. General Electric Hitachi is also developing an advanced form of the technology. And they're all waiting to hear the judgment of the White House's Blue Ribbon Committee on Nuclear Waste, which is due out in 2012. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And that's all from On Science this week. If you'd like to hear or read more, you can visit our website, npr.org/science. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Alison Richards.